Welcome back, fellow true crime enthusiasts, to today's case file, part 5 of the series, Who Murdered Jimmy Gaul? The Boys Next Door. Welcome to Body of Crime, your go-to true crime podcast, where we plunge headfirst into the gripping world of criminal mysteries. Join your hosts, Jose Medina, Crystal Garcia, and Alicia Anaya, as we deliver the full stories, immersing you in the heart of each case. With spine-chilling cases, in-depth analysis, captivating interviews, and a comprehensive examination of the evidence, embark on a thrilling journey with us as we explore bone-chilling cases from around the globe. Whether you're a seasoned true crime enthusiast or a fresh face in the genre, we guarantee to keep you on the edge of your seat. So put on your detective hat, grab your notepad, and get ready to dive into the thrilling world of Body of Crime. If you're just joining us for the first time and have not been following the development of the case, this is the cold case murder of Jimmy Gaul, a bright and adventurous 7-year-old boy who lived in Citrus Heights in the 1960s. In part one of our story, we provided an overview of the life in Citrus Heights in the 1960s and heard from several of the children who lived there as 6, 7, and 8-year-old kids, now who are mostly in their 60s and 70s. The murder of 7-year-old Jimmy Gaul, who vanished in the middle of the day on May 2, 1964, thrust the entire neighborhood into chaos as the entire community showed up to assist in the search of the boy. He would be found the following morning by Melford Burl Vandegrift, known as Van, having been brutally assaulted and strangled, found covered in brush or weeds in a field, not far from his home where all the neighborhood kids played. Part two of our story took us through the subsequent investigation as law enforcement searched for clues, questioned witnesses, bystanders, and even children throughout the community, searching for any semblance of an answer as to who could have committed such an atrocious act against the young, innocent boy. The one thing that investigators seemed certain about was that the murderer was a member of the community. As the investigators ran out of leads and the case went cold, suspicions began to run high, and members of the community began to speculate and ponder who in their community was the killer. The once close-knit community began to experience an exodus of residents as many moved over the subsequent years amid rumors and conjecture. Some of the speculation included many of those who had spent the night of Jimmy's disappearance searching for the boy. It included Vandegrift, who found Jimmy and called the police. He was a family friend and a tutor to Dolores Gaul, known as Dodie, Jimmy's mother. Many saw it odd that he had been out early searching for Jimmy on his own when he found the boy. Another child from the community, Gay Harvey, recalled an odd encounter with the Doolittle patriarch and held on to the story of that encounter for almost 60 years, sharing it for the first time most recently. As an 8-year-old child at the time, her experience with Mr. Doolittle had been unsettling from her perspective as a child. Doolittle had been a close friend of the Gaul family and had been a supporting family that had aided the Gauls after the tragedy. Others reported that some believed Jimmy's own father was responsible, finding it odd that the family relocated so shortly after Jimmy's death. Jimmy's father was never a suspect. There was the Carney theory, with some believing a killer traveling with the carnival that had been in town that weekend had stumbled upon the boy in the middle of a Saturday morning. There was the strange car theory, with multiple sightings of a strange car in the neighborhood. Maybe blue, a Volkswagen, possibly with a for sale sign in the window. The one thing there was no shortage of in Citrus Heights after Jimmy's death was fingers pointing and the ugly churn of the rumor mill. As investigators ran through all possible leads, most were cleared with solid alibis, which included Vandegrift. Mr. Doolittle had never been indicated as a person of interest or a potential suspect for the investigators. This allowed detectives to narrow their focus on three key individuals. a 57-year-old sex offender who has yet to be identified, and two 16-year-olds. One of the 16-year-olds had hopped a flight out of town the following Monday after Jimmy's death. Investigators tracked him down to Oklahoma, where he was interviewed and questioned. The other was still in the neighborhood and lived next door to Jimmy Gall. Part 3 of our series took us to the mysterious manuscript that was mailed to Tracy Ferris, a new resident in the Citrus Heights community. In 2005, the manuscript arriving almost 40 years after Jimmy's untimely demise. The manuscript preceded by an unexpected and impromptu visit to Tracy's home by a former resident of that home, painted a disturbing picture for the new resident who had been oblivious to the horror that happened so many years ago, so very close to her new home. This manuscript would ignite a flame under the cold case as Tracy provided a copy to detectives, with potential for new leads as the manuscript seemed to implicate yet another potential person of interest. The author of the manuscript, Lori Nelson, the sister of the last child to play with Jimmy on the day of his murder, Guy Nelson, seemed to implicate her father in the crime. But the manuscript was vague, and though any witness statement is accepted as truth until proven otherwise, the case stood still yet again, having not provided the clues they needed to further the case. Tracy, eager to stoke the flame and keep the investigation moving forward, took the manuscript to social media and eventually enlisted the help of Karen Lalonde, a private investigator. Part 4 of the series took a hard look at one of the persons of interest who many in the community had felt was a key player in the murder of Jimmy Gall, Melford Burl Vandegrift, or Van, who had found Jimmy on Sunday, the morning after his disappearance. A 20-page written statement to the police that had been penned by Vandegrift himself the week of Jimmy's murder provided not only his alibi, but an accounting of all the actions taken that day in the search for Jimmy, providing real-time details about the search, his involvement, and his thoughts and emotions as he found Jimmy. That experience would haunt Vandegrift for the remainder of his life and also have a significant impact on his children. Today, as we bring you the fifth installment of this series, we take a hard look at the boys who lived next door to Jimmy Gall, the Garreau boys. William, Richard, and Randolph Garreau, who were 15, 14, and 12 at the time Jimmy was murdered, and who many in the community found to be of particular interest in the investigation, along with law enforcement.
The Garreau family is quite large, with origins from both England and Switzerland. The largest concentration of the Garreau family lineage resides in and around Ohio and Florida. The families have thrived in areas of construction, coal mining, and even real estate. In fact, you may find a building, park, and even a street carrying the Garreau family name in some parts of the country. But the Garreau family, who resided in Citrus Heights, California in the early 1960s, was a different story. Donald Louis Garreau, the father of the Garreau boys, was a Scorpio of Swiss descent. He was born on November 10, 1929 in Canton, Ohio, to 23-year-old Charles Edward Garreau, a Garreau Brothers gravel pit shipping clerk, and 19-year-old Mildred Annetta Elizabeth Diddy, a housewife. Donald was one of three children born to the couple. His sister Dorothy was 1 year older than him and his brother David 7 years younger. He grew up in Canton, Ohio amongst a very large family, most hardworking with grounded entrepreneurial spirits. Christina Mae Elton, the Garreau boys' mother, was affectionately known as Tina. She was born in Canton, Ohio on May 1, 1930. A Taurus of German heritage, she was welcomed into the world by her 25-year-old father, William Roy Elton, who worked as a steel mill electric foremast fourth helper, and her 24-year-old mother, Helen Mae Huffman, a housewife. She was the only child in her home, having no siblings. Like Donald, she grew up in Canton, Ohio, but her family paled in size compared to his. Donald and Tina attended Timken High School together. In 1948, their senior year, Donald served as a member of the choral club, while Tina served as a member of the stagecraft club and was the homeroom representative. Donald was described as jovial, nice, and mannerly, and Tina was described as talkative, independent, and original. The two would become high school sweethearts, and Tina would be pregnant by the time the young couple graduated. On February 6, 1949, 19-year-old tool and die maker Donald and 18-year-old housewife Tina would have their first child and son, William Charles Garreau, an Aquarius whom everyone would come to know as Bill. Just a year later, on February 12, 1950, the couple would welcome their second child and son number two, Richard Louis Gouraud, another Aquarius who everyone would come to know as Dick. They would welcome their third child and son just 2 years later, Randolph Eugene Gouraud, on January 13, 1952, a Capricorn who some would come to know as Randy and others would know him as Gene. At the time of Randolph's birth, Donald was serving as a U.S. Navy reservist. The young couple would part ways in 1955. Bill would be 6, Dick would be 5, and Gene would be 3 years old at the time of the split. Elizabeth L. Ellenbrook, a Scorpio whom everyone would come to know as Betty, entered the world on October 15, 1923, to 42-year-old John Ellenbrook Sr. and 34-year-old Anna Schoenfeld, both from Yugoslavia in Akron, Ohio. She was the 5th in line of 6 children. She had 3 older brothers and an older sister, and then a younger brother. Her parents spoke German. She grew up in Ohio, attending Greensburg High School, where she was a member of the a cappella choir, graduating in 1941. Elizabeth married 23-year-old Hugo Andrew Haydu from Canton, Ohio, that same year. The following year, Hugo enlisted in the U.S. Army on April 4, 1942, and on October 22, 1942, they had their first child and daughter, Beverly Ann Haydu. In 1943, she began her career in the aerospace industry and remained focused on her career, not having their second child and only son until February 10, 1953. His name would be Henry Allen Haydu. 26-year-old Donald and 31-year-old Betty would meet and fall into a forever romance, having their last child with one another, Donna Ray Gouraud, on June 14, 1955. This would be Donald's 4th child and only daughter, and it would be Betty's 3rd child and 2nd daughter. The couple would marry the following year on August 25, 1956, and make their way to the sunny state of California. The family of 8, 7 who actually made this trip, would settle in the Sacramento area in Fair Oaks. Beverly was 14, Bill was 7, Dick was 6, Gene was 4, and little Donna was just a year old. Henry, who was just 3 years old, would remain with his father in Ohio. Donald would take a job at Aerojet as a tool designer and join a rifle and pistol league. The family would later move in 1960 to Citrus Heights, California, settling into a new home in the Sylvan Park subdivision, right next door to a young family where a little boy named Jimmy Gall lived.
One of the things that's very important for us to discuss at the start of this episode, because we've talked about a couple people already, is how people come up in a case and how you move away from them. So this is an unsolved case. And so because it's an unsolved case, it's unique in the sense that a murderer has not been identified. This case has not been solved. So you're not doing a bunch of research and then turning around and sharing a story of a case that has already been solved. These kinds of stories can be very hard on the community and very hard on the people that are presented throughout the case. What we don't want to do is we don't want to allude to there being any fact to any one person's statement. And the reason that that is very important is because when law enforcement takes in witness statements, even if you're all sitting at the same table, you're all going to have a different statement. One of you heard something the other one didn't hear. One of you saw something that the other one didn't see. And that's important. It doesn't mean that one of you is right and one of you is wrong. It means that your experience and your perspective is different. And that's okay. And you don't want to lead people. You don't want to say, hey, did you see 2 men in white shirts? And you don't want to do that. What you want to do is you want to ask people the same type of questions. You want to allow for them to answer. And then you line those up and you look at them.
Fleshing out the truth.
Right. And so somewhere in the middle of that, and not that anybody's trying to be dishonest, but somewhere in the middle of that, you're going to be able to piece certain things together. For instance, one of the things that has become very clear in this case is the timeline. We were able to see Vandegrift's actual written statement for the police in his writing. Like, this is an official document that's part of Jimmy Gall's case. And there's a lot of things in that document that we haven't spoken about and we won't speak about because either it doesn't have specific relevance to the case or solving the case, or because it could damage the case, honestly. And that's not what we're here to do. In thinking about all of that, when someone is recalling information, especially as a child, you have to understand that they're telling you their version of what they saw, of what they experienced. And even for, like, I have children, even for my own children, it's funny sometimes when we're recalling something that happened because we all remember it differently. And so, you know, your kid might say, hey, you left me at grandma's all alone and didn't say anything. And maybe that wasn't how it played out, but that's what your kid remembers. So you can't discount what somebody says and say, well, that person's recall is facts and that person's recall is not. And we're not going to do that. It's not fair to do. It's not best practice to do. And it's not an honest way to deliver a story or to look into a case. Now, one of the statements that we received was from Gay Harvey, who was a young child when this occurred and was one of the last people to be out in the field with Jimmy the morning that he disappeared. And in her providing her recollection of that time frame, she named somebody in that statement who had never been mentioned to the police by her. Also, he is somebody who, throughout the course of our investigation, was never mentioned by anybody else.
In preparation for this case, we interviewed a bunch of children from Citrus Heights. They all had different stories to share. We didn't guide them in their stories. We asked for their recollection, and they shared their recollections openly, unguided. In that, one of the children made a statement about her interaction with Mr. Doolittle in the neighborhood. And it had to do with an obstruction to allowing Jimmy to either pass through his yard. This was a name that had never come up in the investigation as anybody to look into or anybody to like question about or anything like that. So this was the first time that this was ever being heard or that it was ever discussed. And it hasn't been brought up by anybody else in the neighborhood as him being a certain kind of way with children or not liking boys playing with girls. Those are some of the comments that we received from Gay in her words. We shared it in the episode. The intent of sharing what her version of the story was to be factual in her recollection of her own story. Not to say that what she says is factual or not factual. We weren't trying to determine whether what she was saying was a fact or not a fact. But in sharing her story, she ties in the timeline, which is what we were looking to solidify. And kind of what you were just saying, Crystal, is when you're aligning common threads within a story, the things that don't align just become a little bit of noise. And you really just focus for those things that align, because that's really what the truth is. So as you're hearing everybody's versions of the truth, you're going to hear different versions because, as you kind of said earlier, people are going to remember things differently. They're going to have seen things differently. They're, you know, based on their experiences, they're going to recall things 60 years later differently. And so what you look for is you look for those common themes. And that's kind of what we were looking for. And in sharing some of those statements, the intent wasn't to say that any of those statements were facts. The intent was to share everyone's recollection at the time. And the common theme that because the investigation had not been solved, there was a lot of conjecture, there was a lot of rumors, there was a lot of finger pointing at people who either the police never considered to be a suspect. Doolittle was never a suspect. Doolittle was never a person of interest. Neither was Jimmy's dad. Vandergriff found the body. He was obviously a person of interest. It's automatic when you find the body. So yes, he had to be ruled out, and he was ruled out. And so in the sharing of that story, some of our listeners have pointed out that there's some inconsistencies. We left those inconsistencies intentionally because the inconsistencies rule out some of the statements that are being made in someone's recollection. So if three people say, we remember it happening at 12 o'clock, and one person says it happened at 2 o'clock, you rule that out as a fact because it's the outlier. You go with the common thread as being what's true or what's factual. There are some statements that are being made by people that are recalling something that happened when they were 6, 7, and 8 years old. We're not alluding to any of those statements to be facts. we're not portraying them as facts. That's why they're in their own words and we're sharing their experience.
The intent is not to make people believe that a particular statement is a fact. We're presenting you some of the different things. And that's part of carrying people through the process of how people are eliminated. Another thing is that we know that this case is going to be told again and again by numerous different people. And it is extremely important to not present things in a way where armchair detectives and web sleuths now take a person's name who's been mentioned and start to dissect their entire family line. As we began looking into this case, we realized that there were some names that came forward that would be natural for the true crime community to want to delve into for obvious reasons, such as Vandegrift finding Jimmy. What we don't want to happen is we don't want people jumping down rabbit holes that take away from the case, because the goal is to find the truth. The goal is to identify all these different statements that come forward and to try to move towards gaining traction in the case and finding truth in the case and possibly finding that person, but not to point fingers and not to allude to any one person's recollection being a fact. So I did want to real quick touch on why the carny was quickly ruled out by the police. And that is because in the multitude of statements that they got from the kids who played with Jimmy that morning, from the adults who saw Jimmy, as they were putting together that timeline and they were listening to what everybody was saying, they realized very quickly that nobody had seen anybody out of place. Nobody had seen anybody that didn't belong in the neighborhood. So they knew very early on that it couldn't have been somebody outside of the neighborhood, that the likelihood of that was extremely low.
I think the other piece of that too is that anyone who would have been in that neighborhood would have been missing from the carnival. This is a Saturday. This is during the day, which means the carnival's ongoing. So that means that if the ring toss guy is missing, like that would be something that would stand out to everybody. That would be an easy no-brainer. You know, hey, the ring toss guy did it. But what about the car?
There was a couple of different statements that were made where somebody possibly saw a car, somebody thought it was a blue car. There was a comment that it could have been a hard top, a soft top. There was a statement that there could have been a for sale sign, that it was a Volkswagen. So again, this is like a bunch of people sitting at a table and trying to recall the same event, regardless of the fact that they were all near each other. So in looking at multiple statements, they're looking to see, okay, what aligned? Okay, multiple people saw a blue car. Okay, multiple people saw a Volkswagen. Okay, a couple people thought they might have saw a for sale sign in the window. So they put that information out to try to see if anybody would come forward and say, hey, I know who owns that car, who's selling that car.
And I know part of what they did was they took Guy Nelson, who actually saw Jimmy standing at a car talking to some kids, and they actually took him on a drive with his dad through the neighborhood, looking to see if he recognized the car that he saw Jimmy standing by.
Right. What's interesting about that is that he mentions Jimmy having his bike at that point. We know that when Jimmy went missing, that his bike was sitting in front of his house. So he did not have his bike at that point in time. And that's an important detail because we know that he's seen with the car with his bike. So does that car have relevance if he now does not have his bike? So those are the small details that sometimes people feel aren't important when they're sharing information. And that is why it's extremely important to allow for people to openly share without pushing them in a direction and ensuring that you're asking the same information of everybody. Now, if you're allowing for somebody to openly talk, you know, hey, tell me what you remember, write it down, or tell me what you remember, I'm going to record it. That is very important to ensuring that you're getting little pieces that could be missed, because you might capture something in there that you didn't intend to capture that could be important.
It could be relevant.
Right. When you have people in a case, an older case like this, sometimes you have members from the community that will come in and now talk about it. And without even thinking about it, now when they're retelling the story, they'll take some information that came from somebody else that isn't their own, and they'll now share that as part of the story that they're telling.
Right.
And so those are things that law enforcement is aware of. Those are things that we're aware of that occur when you're talking to people and the case is older and people have been talking.
It's hard to differentiate between what you remember and what you've learned as being separate.
That's true.
And so it blends together. And so even though you may not have seen a blue car, you've heard it enough times to think that maybe you did see a blue car. You know what I'm saying? Something like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The other piece of the introduction that I wanted to kind of go over, because I think that was really important, because I know we've gotten some feedback about some of our earlier episodes in terms of implication or and even sharing original statements from some of the children from back then. You have to take it with a grain of salt. That's an 8-year-old child that remembers something, and that doesn't make it factual. That just makes it her memory. Right. And so the fact comes when there's alignment, and we haven't found any alignment, any additional statements from anybody else saying they had a similar or a same type of an experience.
Right.
So it's a child's story at this point.
You know, in cases where you see somebody who has very violent behavior, you know, we know that Jimmy's assault and murder was brutal. And we've actually covered a couple cases similar to this. There's one that we covered just last year. And there are very distinct things that occur in a child's life that manifest later into some of these behaviors. And we know that they don't stop. So another thing in looking at somebody who committed this particular crime is you have to look at other behaviors and patterns that either occurred before Jimmy's assault and murder or after. You can't just say, oh, I think it could be this person. It must be this person. You know, this is the one crime that they did and then they never did anything again. The likelihood of that is highly improbable.
Yeah.
So in digging into the Garreau family, you know, you see that the Garreaus came here from another country. They settled, most of them very hard workers, really, you know, self-made family, very big family, very well-known family. And then you see this portion of the family who kind of, it appears, kind of split off from the rest of the family and wasn't like the rest of the family. And the unfortunate thing about that is that when you look at the probability of a child being successful and really having the best opportunities available to them, they had that. Like if they wanted to be self-made millionaires, they could have been that. If they wanted to start a family business, they could have done it. They had everything available at their fingertips. So what went wrong? The boys' parents got married straight out of high school. And it appears that she got pregnant while she was in high school. And still back around that time frame, that was kind of a given that you were going to get married, you're going to be together. So they had their kids pretty back to back. And then you see that, you know, that they split. And they could have matured and kind of grew apart. There's no details significant as to their split. The blending of the families, Elizabeth's child that she came into the relationship with. So she had two children, and from all appearances, her son really never lived with them. He lived the entire time with his father, and her daughter was older. She was already a teenager. She was older. The other kids would have been little kids that she could have babysitted. So there wasn't like this, you know, where they kind of got to grow up together and that kind of thing. The blending of their family was not how you see a lot of blended families where there's kids that are like, you know, similar in age and, you know, that kind of thing. The Garreau brothers seemed to be a handful, and they were well known by many in the neighborhood as the boys who were often in trouble. Donald, their father, worked full-time at Aerojet and was a competitive member of the Valley Rifle League with the Aerojet Rifle and Pistol Club team, where he competed often. All three of the boys became Boy Scouts in the Boy Scouts of America out of Citrus Heights, known as Troop and Explore Post 228, from 1961 to about 1963. Donald was active with the troop, participating as a scoutmaster, traveling when they did short trips, focused on leadership, skill building, and earning skill badges. When Jimmy was murdered, Betty became frustrated that her boys were being suspected of anything nefarious due to their constant mischievous behavior and their known dislike for Jimmy, according to several of the children in the neighborhood. In fact, neighbors spoke about the family's odd interactions and spoke of the boys often remaining secluded in their rooms, their residence in eerie quietness with no communication or what many perceived as normal activity.
With Donna, that dynamic was really strange. She did not socialize. She had no other girlfriend. She stayed in her house, in her bedroom. She had three brothers. I went to church with them every Sunday. And her mother worked as a waitress at Grant. Her dad, he came home around 5:30 every day in a white shirt. It looked like a civilian job. You know, he was not a construction guy. The brothers, that was weird. They had one room that they shared, and Donna had the bigger room. Donna was their stepsister, and she was like the prima donna of the house. She had every toy you could think of. She had lots of stuff, lots of nice clothes, toys. So we would play in her bedroom, but I was only allowed over there if her mother was there, and I was supervising. Later it was if the brothers were even home, I couldn't. But that was after Jimmy passed. She had no relationship with her brothers. She did not like them. It's like the house had no communication going on. It was very quiet. It was clean. It was orderly. Even when we went to church, the car was quiet. When we went and had lunch every Sunday after church, we'd go to Grant's and her mom was the waitress there. We'd sit at the table. They would chit-chat across from each other, but I was taught to just sit and eat and, you know, do your manners and stuff, and kind of like an adult's world, so I never had a conversation. They really, I don't think her dad really even knew me, and this went on for almost 2 years. It was strange, but her brothers were strange. It's almost like they were sneaking around, you know, and trying to really avoid Donna. She disliked them. She didn't want anything to do with them. And they were not, like, coming in her area, not even come to her room to ask her a question. And then Donna, when they moved, was writing me from Washington. And it wasn't in the fifth grade. She was already telling me about some of her boyfriend sex and asking me what I've done. And that's when I stopped communicating with her. That this wasn't my thing. Yeah. She was kind of bragging. So she was promiscuous at a young age. And I was very uncomfortable with what she was saying. I was afraid my mom would read the letter. We didn't even talk about the birds and the bees yet. The house was always clean. And they had nice things. And it just seemed like it was a false house. There was not happiness. There was not joy. It was just existence. And then her oldest daughter from a previous marriage would come over on the weekends and they'd sit out in the backyard and tan. She talked a lot back then with her daughter, but that was it. They never came out in the front yard. They did not socialize with any of the neighbors.
Even Betty wasn't aware of who her boys were and what they would become. After Jimmy's death, Betty moved to Washington State with Donna, and within 3 years of Jimmy's death, by 1966, the entire family was reunited there. Dick graduated from Samish High School in Bellevue in 1968, while Jean attended Interlake High School, but he did not graduate. The family would relocate yet again to Chula Vista, California, in about 1969. The moves the Garreau family made typically coincided with the trouble their boys found themselves in.
In order to understand why our investigation turned towards the Garreaus in Jimmy's case, it's necessary to understand Bill Garreau's past and who he is presently. As the eldest son at 15, Bill was a freshman at San Juan High School at the time of the assault and murder of young Jimmy Gall. On May 4th, 1964, Bill was arrested at the high school on charges of molesting a 7-year-old girl in the neighborhood, which developed out of the investigation of Jimmy's case. While at the Sacramento County Juvenile Hall, Bill confessed to the molestation of another 7-year-old girl the summer prior. Law enforcement at the time said the boy may be dangerous if left unchecked. Given his history and the fact that he lived right next door to Jimmy, he was a primary person of interest at the time of the investigation. A local news outlet would report that Bill had been arrested for the assault and murder, but were later forced to retract that statement after law enforcement clarified that his arrest was in connection to a separate case and that he had been cleared in Jimmy's case based on his alibi, according to Detective John Anderson and Inspector Graham Butcher. It has been speculated that this was the catalyst for the move to Washington. It became obvious that despite where the boys went, trouble went with them. On June 5, 1967, Bill stole guns and hunting knives from his uncle Glenn Garreau in September of that same year, and he was arrested and charged for the theft. Meanwhile, his brothers Dick and Gene were attending two different high schools in Washington State. Though Dick would graduate, Gene would not, and the family again picked up and moved. Around March of 1969, then 20-year-old Bill Garreau decided to become an assistant scoutmaster with the Boy Scouts of America in Philo, California, with the Anderson Valley Boy Scout Troop 51, a volunteer position. In less than a month, the Anderson Valley Junior-Senior High School principal contacted the Sheriff's Department after he received a report that Bill had been seen in a blue station wagon in and around the school grounds where he had picked up three students, a 13-year-old and two 14-year-old girls, taking them to the Jones residence where he was staying. At the time, Bill was utilizing the name William Francis Elton, his maternal grandfather's first and last name. At 5'6", Bill weighed approximately 165 pounds with blonde hair and blue eyes. He had attempted to have his way with the girls prior to heading to the Hendy Woods, where he then supplied them with drugs. Within days of the call to the police, Bill would contact the principal and tell him that he would have the most difficult time in levying charges against him. This would become part of the highly publicized Boy Scout perversion files. On May 16, 1969, Bill was arrested by sheriff deputies and taken to the county jail on four counts of contributing to the delinquency of a minor after they arrived at his residence, which he shared with a guy named Jones, over separate complaints and found three girls, all runaways, along with drugs. The case would be dropped by prosecutors citing lack of evidence. On June 3, 1969, Bill was again arrested on charges of army desertion and held in the county jail for the U.S. Army authorities until his transport to the Presidio of San Francisco, California. By October 26, 1970, Bill was once again a free man when he decided to execute an armed robbery. He would face charges for the crime on February of 1971, for which he received probation. After that, Bill found a way to stay off the police radar. After many years of anonymity, Bill found himself back in hot water when he found himself babysitting a 10-year-old girl at her home in Deltona, Florida, where he proceeded to molest and fondle her and one of her young friends. On May 30th, 1991, Bill would be sentenced to 17 years in prison for the molestation charges of the two young girls after pleading no contest to two second-degree felonies, lewd or lascivious assault on a child and sexual battery. He would be in prison from June 3, 1991 to August 1, 1997, serving only 6 years of his 17-year sentence. He remained free from 1997 until 2003, but Bill couldn't stay out of trouble, and after a parole violation on September 3, 2003, Bill was sent back to prison from September 30, 2003 to June 17, 2009. His freedom would be short-lived, and he would be back in prison for a parole violation again, from October 28, 2009 to March 20, 2012. Today, he is in a relationship with a woman 35 years younger than he is, and they share a daughter.
Is it possible that a child who grows up in a home that's completely normal becomes a sex offender? Yes. Is it common? No. Typically, when you have an offender like we see with Bill, there has been some type of behavior that's occurred early in their lives. That doesn't mean that it's their parents. It could be a babysitter. It could be, you know, in his case,
a scoutmaster.
You know, possibly a scoutmaster. And to many children who experience that type of trauma early in their lives, that becomes normal for them. And especially if they experience things close to the puberty age, they then associate those things together and again see it as being normal. They don't see anything wrong with it. And that becomes something for a majority of them where that mindset remains unchanged.
That's very similar to the story that we covered about Larry Dwayne Hall, in where because he was going through puberty at a time when his father was using him to dig up graves and rob graves, he associated the sexuality of seeing dead bodies, naked dead bodies and stuff like that with sex, and that kind of contributed to his behavior that would later manifest, you know, as violent sex and necrophilia and stuff like that. When you associate a certain type of behavior with your sexuality, then it becomes a normal part of your sexuality. And so we're not saying that Bill Gouraud was molested as a child, but the evidence is high that he was probably molested as a child, which would then lead to re-victimization in the future if he chose to go that route. Now every child who is victimized doesn't become a perpetrator, but typically a perpetrator has been victimized, typically.
Right. That is true. One thing that obviously that stands out with Bill is the fact that he has a very obvious pattern of behavior that is not good behavior. You have assaults on 2 7-year-old girls, very young, and he would have been around that time, 14, 15 years old. So when those occurred.
Yeah, and we saw this same type of behavior in another case that we covered with the Henrietta murders with Jesse McFadden, who also began around that same age, of that 15, 16-year-olds assaulting kids in that same age group.
Right. And it's something that if you were to go and research really any case where there's any type of sexual deviance or a progression in crime from sexual deviance to murder, you're going to see a pattern. And typically that behavior starts early, and you typically see kind of the first very serious progression around that puberty age.
Right.
That's very, very common. So then after his teen years, which typically you wouldn't know who these individuals are, because in just about every state, a juvenile record is sealed and you wouldn't know. You wouldn't even know that he had these crimes prior to the age of 18.
Right. Which is probably how he got into the military, because he would have had a sealed record.
Yeah, he would have. So you see that this progresses, you know, you see that, you know, he continues to get in trouble in some form or fashion. In his behavior, a lot of people will question, was he doing certain things that would have made it seem like he would be a person of interest in this particular case? And, you know, I've heard a lot of people say, well, typically people don't cross gender lines, or they don't cross, you know, if they like a certain age group, they stick with that certain age group. And there's something very important that I want everybody to be aware of, and that's that it depends on their primary motive. For a lot of offenders, it isn't even about the sex. It is about the control. And they'll pick victims that they're able to control, whether they have disabilities, whether they're young, whether they're elderly. They pick people who are vulnerable that they can control. And it doesn't matter if it's a female or a male, it's about control. And for some of them, it's about things like sadism, like pain. So it doesn't have to be that it's a specific gender. It depends on, again, what their motive is.
We've seen that in other cases with, like, even the one I just referenced earlier about the Henrietta case with Jesse McFadden, where he was in prison assaulting other prisoners.
Right.
Men. He was obviously bisexual, but he considered himself to be heterosexual.
A lot of people would have assumed that he wouldn't have crossed lines. But also, you know, there's some red flags or behaviors that you see in sex offenders or sex deviants. And some of those include things like manipulation, grooming. You know, a lot of them exhibit grooming behavior. And grooming behavior starts off very innocent. They befriend somebody. They befriend a kid who doesn't have a lot of friends, or a kid who would be considered kind of a high-risk kid, or a kid with vulnerabilities that makes them easy targets. And just grooming them because they're younger and they're older and they're able to do that because they're using these different tools that they've learned as a predator through the years.
You see it in his interaction with the girls that he picked up from the high school, where he takes them out and he takes them to get drugs and things like that. That's a form of grooming, and it's predatory behavior.
you know, and even getting into a position of power. So becoming a scoutmaster, and there's some things there that are a little bit odd. One of the things is that the fake name that he uses when he goes and he applies to be a volunteer for the Boy Scouts is his biological mother's father's name, the first name and the last name. The middle name was actually a middle name of another family member also on her side of the family.
Oh.
So he combined these names and used that name as his name to try to keep, you know, police or anybody. And it's probably honestly why he told the principal, like, you're going to have a hard time getting
right.
Another form of thinking that he has some type of power or control. Some other things that you might see are like boundary violation. They're attempting to cross boundaries and when they're trying to push it. So they're trying to see how far across that line they can get each time, you know, oh, well, if I just push a little bit more, or if I groom a little bit more, now I can do a little bit more, what they're going to allow for me to do. Some of them lack empathy, not all of them. And then recidivism, are they ending up back in prison over and over and over? There's been a lot of research that's been done on sex offenders where they've done very high numbers of very detailed information that they've obtained from them anonymously so that they're honest. And the number of offenders who have molested children over and over, never got caught, nobody ever told on them, is ridiculous. So to think as well that you would see, you know, things all the time, or that children would speak out all the time. One of the things that came up in the course of Jimmy Gall's case is the assault of the 2 7-year-old girls. And one of the girls, while he was being questioned about that girl, he admitted to another girl that he had assaulted that previous summer. So initially, those girls didn't just come to the police and tell the police or tell their parents, and their parents reported it. You know, that could have been something that was, didn't come up for years, that these girls later had issues with, which is so very unfortunate. And then you might see some deviant sexual interests, you know, things that people think are strange. You might see some commonality in their victim selection, or maybe you don't, if it's, you know, power and control is their main motive. And then
I know part of it is also too, there are some predators that are just, it's all about opportunity crimes. So it's not really based off of whether it's a girl or a boy, or whether it's a 7-year-old and a 12-year-old. It's just about the opportunity. That child is the opportunity at the moment. And so they violate that child because it's opportunistic.
Right. That's very, very true. There can be patterns of deception. And then, you know, maybe early warning signs that you see where, you know, behavior isn't normal. Those types of behavior are typically identified by parents and addressed, maybe a school teacher or friend's parent who addresses something. At a particular age, especially as a parent, when you're seeing how your kid interacts with people, sometimes you'll notice things where you're like, something's up with that kid. I don't want you to hang out with that kid. Sometimes you notice those things. And obviously, while they were young, their stepmother, it bothered her that the boys automatically had fingers pointed at them when Jimmy was found, because she's thinking like, okay, yeah, my boys are in trouble, but like, seriously, you think, you know, they did something like this? And you know what? At that point, honestly, I think she was in denial, because today she would have a very different tune.
Hindsight's always 20/20.
Right. A lot of parents aren't aware of the fact that when you bring a child in at a certain age, that sometimes the damage is so significant that it is extremely rare to be able to pull them out of that. And it's unfortunate, but it's true. And it happens a lot with kids in the foster care system, when families take in kids and, you know, they want to adopt them. A lot of those kids have damage that is so bad that it's hard to pull them out of that.
Yeah. I hate to keep going back to cases that we've covered, but we've covered so many that have to do with children that were sexually abused. And I kind of go back to the Menendez brothers, who were severely sexually abused as children and who ended up murdering their parents. The trauma is so deep and so impactful that it changes who they are as people. They're not the same children they would have been minus the abuse.
Right. And one of the things actually that's, you know, because social isolation is something that's recognized as a pattern as well sometimes. And that's something that was very evident in that case. So the family was keeping them isolated from very many people. They didn't have a lot of interactions with people outside of their, even their immediate family. There were different family members that came out and talked about how even in the house, when they would visit, they weren't allowed to go in certain areas of the house. The kids were isolated. And so that made it easier for them to keep the whole story under wraps. And that has been a common theme in a lot of cases, unfortunately.
We've covered, yes. Whoever is violating the child is exerting a significant amount of control to keep them quiet and keep them from putting the secret out and letting anybody know what's going on. But that doesn't stop the behavior from presenting, especially as that child becomes older and starts like acting out.
And a lot of people question too, like, well, they're a parent. Why would they, or how could they? It's common, believe it or not. You know, people will say, well, they were
common than it should be.
Yeah. And women too. So not even just men, but, and then people will also question, well, they were in a relationship. That doesn't matter either. Bill is and has been a sexual deviant and is a lifetime registered sex offender. Many members of the Citrus Heights community have come forward about interactions and knowledge about Bill Garreau. Given Bill's colorful beginnings prior to the assault and murder of Jimmy Gall and his continued behavior over the years, he has remained a person of interest in the death of Jimmy Gall. Several members of the Citrus Heights community have described the relationship between Bill and Jimmy as being unfriendly, and his behavior towards Jimmy was pretty unkind. His alibi to detectives at the time of Jimmy's murder cleared him as a suspect, but he was only one of the Garreau boys and not the only Garreau brother with a colorful past. During that time, when detectives would clear suspects, it wasn't as fine-tuned as it is today, and there wasn't a lot of receipts to show back in that time frame. Showing your GPS of where you are, showing your phone of where you are. There's a lot of things that didn't happen back in that time frame that happen today. Join us in our next episode as we sink deeper into the darkness of the Garreau boys' past, uncovering similar inclinations for sexual deviance, pedophilia, and yes, murder, as we continue shedding light on the sinister truths that have remained hidden within the shadows of the Citrus Heights, California community. As we dig deeper, peeling back the layers of the secrets that the family next door didn't want you to know. On our journey to find justice for Jimmy Gall.
And that's a wrap on today's investigation, fellow detectives. If you found this episode both enlightening and captivating, then please subscribe to our podcast show and our Patreon. Leave a review and hit that like button. Share our podcast with others and engage with us on our website and social media platforms. You can find us on all major podcast platforms as well as our website at www.bodyofcrimepodcast.com, where you can access all of our episodes and bonus content, including valuable resources. By expanding our community, we believe we can make a greater impact in our pursuit of truth and in shedding light on crucial cases. If there's a case that you'd like for us to cover or a personal story you'd like to share, please don't hesitate to contact us through our website. We always welcome your feedback and suggestions. Until next time, stay sharp and thank you for tuning in to the Body of Crime Podcast.
Bye.